You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for Catholic News Read by Chris Mihalik. Sources are the National Catholic Register, Catholic News Agency, and the Denver Catholic. Pope Leo XIV, in his first major document, says, "The poor evangelize us." In the first major document of his pontificate, Pope Leo XIV writes that the poor are not only objects of charity, but evangelists who can prompt us to conversion through their example of weakness and reliance on God. The poor can act as silent teachers for us, making us conscious of their presumption, of our presumption, and instilling within us a rightful spirit of humility. Leo writes in De Laxitate, "I Have Loved You," released by the Vatican on Thursday. The elderly, for example, by their physical frailty, remind us of our own fragility, even as we attempt to conceal it behind our apparent prosperity and outward appearance. The poor remind us how uncertain and empty our seemingly safe and secure lives may be. The pontiff quotes his predecessor throughout the document, which was first drafted during the previous pontificate, and draws heavily on Pope Francis's first apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, on the joy of the gospel. An apostolic exhortation is one of the most authoritative genres of papal teaching, typically focused on the pastoral application of doctrine. Christ's whole life is an example of poverty, Leo writes, and the Church, if it wants to belong to Christ, must give the poor a privileged place. For Christians, the poor are not a sociological category, but the very flesh of Christ, he writes. The Lord took on a flesh that hungers and thirsts and experiences infirmity and imprisonment. Leo signed the exhortation on October 4th, the feast of St. Francis of Assisi, who is traditionally known as Tu Poverello, the poor little man. The pontiff explains at the beginning of the document that he received it as an inheritance from Pope Francis, who was working on it during the final months of his life. The document traces the Church's perennial teaching on the poor, drawing on the Old and New Testaments, the practice of the early Christian community, the writings of church fathers and doctors, the lives of the saints, the document of the Second Vatican Council, and the magisterium of the popes and St. John Paul XXIII. Leo also commends the example of contemplative and active religious orders throughout history that have helped the poor with health care, food, shelter, and education. Every moment of renewal within the Church has always been a preferential concern for the poor. In this sense, her work with the poor differs in its inspiration and method from the work carried out by any other humanitarian organization. Technological progress has not eradicated poverty, which only continues to appear in diverse forms, the Pope writes. He defines the poor to include the incarcerated victims of sexual exploitation, those affected by the degradation of the environment, and immigrants. The Church, like a mother, accompanies those who are walking. Where the world sees threats, she sees children. Where walls are built, she builds bridges. And she knows that in every rejected migrant, it is Christ himself who knocks at the door of the community. Leo denounces prejudices that he says can lead Christians to neglect their duty to the poor. There are those who say, "Our task is to pray and teach sound doctrine," and argue that it is the government's job to care for the poor, or that it would be better not to lift them out of their poverty, but simply to teach them to work, he writes. Sometimes pseudoscientific data are invoked to support the claim that a free market economy will automatically solve the problem of poverty, or that the rich can enact more effective solutions, the Pope writes. Leo condemns such views as worldly and superficial and devoid of any supernatural light. De Laxitate also emphasizes the spiritual needs of the poor, arguing that those are more important than the material, yet often ignored by the church. It is not a question of providing for welfare assistance and working to ensure social justice. Christians should also be aware of another form of inconsistency in the way they treat the poor. In reality, the worst discrimination which the poor suffer is the lack of spiritual care, the Pope writes, quoting Pope Francis. Leo ends his exhortation by emphasizing the duty of almsgiving, which he claims has fallen out of fashion, even among believers. Almsgiving, however modest, brings a touch of pietas, piety, into a society otherwise marked by the frenetic pursuit of personal gain, adding that although it will not be the solution to poverty in the world, it will touch our hearts. Our love and our deepest convictions need to be continually cultivated, and we do so through our concrete actions, he continues, remaining in the realm of ideas and theories while failing to give them expression through frequent and practical acts of charity, eventually cause even our most cherished hopes and aspirations to weaken and fade away. For this very reason, we Christians must not abandon almsgiving. It can be done in different ways, and surely more effectively, but it must continue to be done. It is always better at least to do something rather than nothing. Standing against hate, Catholic Jews, and the story that holds us together by guest contributor Matt Walker. For the first time in 50 years, anti-Semitism routinely appears on American streets and in American public places. Those words may sound like they belong in a history book. Instead, they opened a public discussion held last month at the University of Colorado in Boulder. The urgency was not theoretical. On June 1st, a group walking Boulder's 16th Street Mall in support of hostages taken during the October 2023 attack on Israel was ambushed by a man wielding a homemade flamethrower and Molotov cocktails. 8 were wounded, and 82-year-old Karen Diamond later died from her burns. This attack came just weeks after a firebombing of the Pennsylvania governor's residence and the murder of 2 Israeli embassy staffers in Washington, D.C., 2 tragedies which underscored the deadly persistence of anti-Semitic violence. Against this backdrop, CU's Benson Center for the Study of Western Civilization convened concerned Coloradans, students, and faculty to hear Catholic and Jewish leaders reflect on the modern resurgence of anti-Semitism and how faith, history, and solidarity point to hope. George Weigel, syndicated Denver Catholic columnist and biographer of St. John Paul II, addressed these growing threats from the Catholic perspective. He noted that for John Paul II, defending Jews was not an abstract teaching, but an intensely personal conviction formed by childhood friendships in his hometown of Varavitsa, where one in five residents was Jewish. Young Karol Wojtyła had many Jewish friends as a boy and a teenager. Some of them remained his friends for life. Others perished in the Shoah Holocaust, Weigel said. The Second World War, this cauldron of hatred and violence, was the most formative experience of Karol Wojtyła's life, and it was through that experience that he came to the decision to dedicate himself to the defense of human dignity and freedom through the priesthood of the Catholic Church. That lifelong defense left a profound mark on both Catholics and Jews. After the saintly Pope's death, Rabbi Michael Shudrich, Chief Rabbi of Poland, wrote, "For the past 2,000 years, no one did so much for Jewish-Christian dialogue and reconciliation as John Paul II. He taught us in a very special way what it means to love all people, all God's creatures. The world has lost an important moral authority, his moral compass. Poland has lost its greatest teacher and hero. The Jews have lost their best friend and defender." Weigel urged the audience to follow that Christ-like example with clarity today. The range of acceptable political language and ideas with respect to anti-Semitic language, tropes, images, and concepts has been opened far too wide over the past several years, and it is our solemn duty to slam the window shut. Rabbi Meir Y. Soloveitchik, senior rabbi of America's oldest Jewish congregation and director of the Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University, joined Weigel in offering historical and theoretical insights in his remarks. Rabbi Soloveitchik aimed to answer why the hatred of Jews has persisted across millennia. He pointed to the discovery of a 3,200-year-old Egyptian stele listing one pharaoh's victory of many nations, including the total destruction of Israel. This obituary is the oldest known reference to the Jewish people outside of the Bible itself. Yet over 3,000 years later, it is the other nations mentioned on that stone that have vanished, while Israel still remains. This stele instructs us not only about the history of the past, but the miracles of the present, Rabbi Soloveitchik explained. We could see this endurance as a sign of wonder, as a message from God. But there are those who ask, why are the Jews still here? Not with awe, but with envy and hatred. They look not to providence, but to conspirational calumnies. It must be, they say, because Jews control the markets or the media. This is the sort of thinking that fuels a fire that sees in every Jew an enemy. To both speakers, the red thread was clear. History is not random. It is God's story, and his people's story lies at the center. John Paul II's approach to Jews and Judaism was shaped by the conviction that the world story and the biblical story are not stories running on parallel tracks, Weigel said. The biblical study is the world story rightly understood. That story, he explained, is not cyclical repetition, but a journey with purpose, beginning with the Exodus fulfilled in Christ and carried forward in the church's witness to dignity and freedom. Rabbi Soloveitchik echoed that hope, especially in America, by recalling George Washington's correspondence after becoming president. The new country's many faith traditions each wrote the new president a letter, including three separate Jewish communities. Washington replied to each, including one Savannah Jewish community, with words still striking today. May the same wonder-working deity who long since delivering the Hebrews from the Egyptian oppressors planted them in the promised land, whose providential agency has lately been conspicuous in establishing these United States as an independent nation, still continue to water them with the dews of heaven and to make the inhabitants of every denomination participate in the temporal and spiritual blessings of that people. In other words, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, Washington is looking to the God-ordained story of biblical Israel and saying to the Jews of America, your story inspires our story. The Boulder gathering held on a day of fresh violence from the assassination of Charlie Kirk to a Colorado school shooting tied to online Nazi propaganda was undeniably sobering. Yet in recalling John Paul II's friendship, the endurance of the Jewish people and America's founding vision, speakers pointed not only to threats, but to hope. History is not merely a series of random events happening in succession. It is a story guided by God. And in that story, Jews and Catholics alike are called to be witnesses to dignity, lights to the nations, and defenders of freedom. John Paul II's fervent wish that Jews and Christians be a blessing to one another, as he put it, was not only focused on the pain of the past, but on the possibilities of the future, Weigel said, so that the world, in learning its true story, might recover its moral sanity, so that the peoples whose basic moral code comes from Sinai might be lights to the nations, witnesses to human dignity, and defenders of human freedom, so that together Jews and Christians might remind the world that history is his story, God's story, and that our human dignity is ennobled, not diminished, by taking the same path through the history taken by God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus. Do right and left belong in the Catholic Church? By Jared Stout. The partisan division that runs deep in America has recently taken a violent turn. Political affiliations manifest competing visions for the country's future and increasingly for human life itself. Is freedom absolute in a way that should progress no matter the consequences? Or are there fundamental truths and goods that should be conserved and respected? We often speak of the fundamental divide between these general positions as right-wing and left-wing, conservative and liberal, as solely political, without realizing the surprising Catholic connection to their origin. It's common to hear Catholics object to the use of right, left, and conservative liberal labels in the Church. Nonetheless, it's impossible to deny the existence of factions that have arisen broadly along these lines. Factions are nothing new, of course, as St. Paul made clear to the Corinthians. For in the first place, when you assemble as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and I partly believe it, for there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. Controversies over doctrine, liturgy, and morality tend to divide into two major factions, and conservative and liberal labels capture, in a generally accurate way, the positions of either preservation or innovation. Contemporary divisions within the Church, although not identical to political camps, often align in surprising ways. This reality took center stage recently as a major figure in the progressive Catholic camp, Cardinal Blaise Pupic, created enormous controversy in seeking to honor a Democratic politician, Senator Dick Durbin, with a long track record of supporting abortion. On the other hand, churchmen dedicated to the defense of human life, marriage, and religious freedom often find allies in the Republican Party. In fact, three bishops in the United States currently serve on President Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. Given dynamics both within and outside of the church, the left and right, or liberal and conservative, should not be diminished as inapplicable or irrelevant. Right and left, as political labels go back to the French Revolution, particularly to the National Assembly, where representatives lined up either to the right or left of the assembly's president, depending on whether they supported the rights of the king, the right, the position of most Catholics, or favored abolishing the monarchy, the left, and the rights of the church along with it. After the king's downfall, those who considered to be on the right favored a restoration of the ancient regime, while the left continued to advocate for the further liberalization of society along Republican or Democratic lines. This political division carried enormous religious significance as one side advanced the French notion of the renewal of any public role for the church and the legalization of divorce, while the other sought to restore the union of throne and altar. Following the French Revolution, popes supported the restoration of Catholic monarchs, and even disciplined priests who advocated for democracy. The Second Vatican Council, however, brought about a rehabilitation for Catholics holding positions associated with political liberalism by fostering greater openness to the modern world. Vatican II largely buried the traditional right-left division among Catholics who had supported either the restoration of monarchy or modern democracy, although the word democracy does not appear in its document. The right-left divide in recent decades now mostly breaks along the lines of those who support traditional values within the modern democracy, the new right, versus those continuing to push the revolution against any form of traditional authority and morality, the new left. Vatican II, however, created a new form of the right-left divide, not wholly unrelated to the prior usage. On one hand, there is the conservative or traditional movement, which emphasizes continuity with the church's tradition prior to the church's particularly in restoration to the liturgy. On the other hand, progressives stress openness to modern culture shaped by modern democracy and its emphasis on freedom. Pope Benedict XVI had his own way of characterizing it as two competing hermeneutics interpretations of Vatican II, typified on the one hand by discontinuity and rapture, which has frequently availed itself of the sympathies of the mass media, and also one trend of modern theology. On the other hand, he identifies a hermeneutic of reform, typified by renewal in the continuity of the one subject church, which the Lord has given to us, addressed to Roman Curia, December 22, 2005. This divide certainly exists and shapes how many pursue priorities in the church, often those dedicated to conserving the theological tradition of the church also seek to uphold fundamental values of life and the family. Those who favor rapture in matters of doctrine and morality often prioritize social justice over other issues. Perhaps factions are inevitable or even necessary, as Pope conceded. Catholics must take a stand on pressing issues, social ones such as voting and spiritual ones, like finding a new parish, with many willing to drive outside their immediate territorial parish for more traditional or contemporary options. In an age of change, when everything seems in flux, Catholics face two major choices, either to dig in their heels to some degree or follow along with the current of change. The body of Christ, however, cannot be divided in its essence. Factions may exist due to human weakness, though there is only one Lord, one faith, one baptism, Ephesians 4:5. Even as we take a stand, work with like-minded people, and oppose evil, we must do so as Christians who ultimately transcend party politics. More than a call to get along, we need a primary commitment to Christ that arises above divisions and other allegiances. The Beatitudes offer a concrete path to transcend factionalism and rise above squabbles, no matter how important. We will be blessed if we seek the kingdom before all else, make peace, remain meek and merciful, and suffer for righteousness' sake rather than retaliating or seeking revenge. Why Gilmore Girls Still Teaches Me About Real Freedom by Marie San Jose. Every fall, without fail, I queue up Gilmore Girls. It's just the ultimate cozy fall show. The leaves in Star Hollow, the endless coffee, sweaters, scarves, and iconic Friday night dinners, it all screams autumn in a way no other series really does. Recently, while celebrating 25 years of Gilmore Girls at Emmys, even Lauren Graham joked, 25 years ago, a show called Gilmore Girls premiered and apparently took the season of fall hostage. But the older I get, the more I watch it with different eyes. As a teen, Laurie Lee seemed like the coolest mom alive. She's quick-witted, rebellious, the perfect best friend mom. Now, look at her now and think, I'm so glad my mom is nothing like you. She hides truths, avoids responsibility, and often pushes Rory into situations without much foresight. Meanwhile, the classy Emily Gilmore, forever painted as the controlling villain, actually comes across as someone trying, albeit stiffly, to provide Rory with some stability and structure during incredibly formative years. And here's the kicker. Laurie Lee's questionable choices end up paving the way for Rory to make her own questionable choices. Rory, why did you drop out of Yale? It's like generational deja vu. Now that I'm an expectant first-time mom, I can assure you I would never make those mistakes. Laura Lee makes so many questionable choices in front of her daughter and constantly avoids structure for the sake of being fun. And no, my kid is not dropping out of Yale. Hold me to that in 20 years. So where am I going with all this? Often we think of freedom as doing whatever we want. No rules, no boundaries, total independence. But that's not real freedom. True freedom is the power to choose the good, to align our will with God's will. That's where purpose and joy are found, in choosing love, truth, and ultimately union with Him. God desires us to live in that kind of freedom, but He never forces Himself on us. He invites us to relationships with Him. He pursues our hearts, and then He leaves the choice to us. Which brings me back to Laura Lee and Emily. Laura Lee represents love and freedom, but often without boundaries, which leads Rory to make poor choices. Emily represents discipline and structure, but often without tenderness. In reality, God the Father gives us love with both mercy and justice, which may be the hidden beauty of Gilmore Girls. Rory bouncing between those poles, learning sometimes the hard way that real freedom isn't about casting off all limits, but about learning how to live well within them. And that's why every fall I come back to Star Hollows, not just for the vibes, but for those messy, complicated lessons that land differently as the years go by. And now with the baby on the way, I find myself hoping I can offer both Laura Lee's warmth and Emily's structure, mercy and discipline, freedom and truth. Thank you for joining us for Catholic News, read by Chris Mihalik.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.